Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Michael Spence of Stanford University and chair of the Commission on Growth and Development, which reported in May 2008. Mike and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in San Francisco in January 2009, and I began by asking him how the project began.
Well, you know, the guy who was the secretary of the commission, wonderful guy named Roberto Zaga, who's a longtime World Bank guy, I had given, at his request, a lecture at the Poverty Reduction Economic Management Network part of the bank's meeting in 2005, and he asked me to talk about growth, and he wanted a microeconomic perspective, which was my background, and I've been thinking about, you know, sort of information technology and what it was doing to the structure of markets, and somewhere along the line I had realized, although I don't know how Roberto knew this, that the big effects of this technology had to do with sort of distance, collapsing distance and time, which is now kind of so well known it's almost not worth saying. And I was once sort of wondering what it was going to do, but I mean, there was a kind of element of inclusiveness, you know, by integrating things into the global economy, whether they're labor markets or batches of valuable human resources or reducing transaction costs and, you know, making extended supply chains run much, much more efficiently, you know, lower product cycles and so on. And so he asked me to talk about it, and out of that came a suggestion that why didn't we put together a commission of this type. And the way we did it was we decided, because they knew a lot of these people and I knew a few of the others, that we'd ask them and see if they thought it was useful. And the underlying idea was to focus on growth because there was a sense in which, in a lot of very useful activity, that sort of growth in its relation to poverty reduction had sort of been lost item. So that's kind of how we got going. We conducted the test, and virtually everybody said, yeah, let's give it a try. And you know the list of people in the commission. And so then we said, will the World Bank support it? And we can, and because we didn't want it to be, we wanted it to be independent. This is not a group that's going to work for an institution. We asked the UK government and the Swedish government and the Danish government, and, no, Dutch government, Australia eventually, and the Hewlett Foundation. So they all supported us. And that's where this sort of massive $4 million apparently came from. I don't know where that's all coming from. I think a lot of these things are sort of fighting old battles, and I wasn't around. I was around, but I wasn't, you know, part of them because I was doing something else. And then, you know, and then I think we basically got the group together in, well, there was a transition in the World Bank leadership. Jim Wolfensohn stepped down and Paul Wolfowitz came in. And Wolfowitz, you know, because he was new and, you know, had a different approach to running the bank and it was a little kind of rocky, we basically didn't get an answer about whether the World Bank was going to support it. And because Roberto and Danny Leipziger, who was the head of the PRIM network and the vice chairman of the commission, were kind of, that was sort of important. I eventually actually almost gave up on it, you know, and then I wrote an email and said, look, you know, I mean, we've raised some money, and we've got these commissioners on board. We ought to either abandon the thing, give the money back. And I meant immediately. This was in early 2006, and that seemed to unlock it, so we proceeded.
What do you think the key new contributions of the report are, Mike, to the debate about this massive issue of achieving sustainable growth in so many impoverished countries in the world?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask, but I mean, I can tell you what the hope was. The hope was that we would characterize growth sufficiently accurately to accomplish a number of things for practitioners. One is to embolden them to be, you know, a little aggressive, a little experimental, and to kind of do things their own way. We wanted at least to support the notion that this really, while there are principles and they're important, you know, what an economist would call the outlines of a model and which provides some guidance, they just gets to be country specific very quickly, and the politics, you know, the sequencing, occasional opportunism when something presents itself. The, you know, getting rid of bad ideas, you know, when they surface is probably, none of which appears in the kind of purely economic version of it, seems terribly important. So we wanted to, provide, in a sense, a set of tools, a framework that made people a little more confident about venturing out to develop a set of strategies and policies to achieve growth. And we wanted, I guess, also to underline its importance and to underline it in such a way that people, you know, the well-intentioned leaders in a whole variety of countries would think, you know, I mean, it's sufficiently hard to do that if you don't get up in the morning and make it a high priority to worry about this, it won't happen. And so we really wanted to up it on the agenda, not to the exclusion of other things, not security, not, you know, health, not sort of basic human rights for sure, but make it a priority. I mean, one of the ways we got to characterize it is I remember asking some people I won't name, said, well, which most accurately characterizes your approach to growth? One, we get up in the morning and we worry about growth and we think, what are the things we really need to do? You know, it's a group. And the second one is, you get up in the morning, you get the policies right by some conventional definition, and then growth turns out to be whatever it is. And a lot of people said to me, well, it's a second. You know, you get policies right, and then, you know, growth will just be whatever it is. But that's not characteristic of the high growth cases. And it's hard to know what getting the policies right means at least in this framework in which you're sort of experimenting and trying to accomplish an objective. So that's what I hope. And I hope it came across as modest. I mean, in the sense of being clear and bold when we thought you could be, but recognizing this is still an area in which we have very incomplete knowledge.
So over the last few months, you've been presenting the report to various international organizations, to various policymakers in countries, yeah. No doubt, and to academic audiences today here in San Francisco.
Right.
What stand out as the reactions that you've been getting? What things really stick in your mind as the way people have reacted to it?
Well, the overall reaction, you know, in all of the environments seems to be it's very useful. I'm kind of seeing it. But there have been critical reactions, but they've been rather few and far between. And then a lot of the reactions are, well, if you went further in this direction, it would help a lot. And I think those are all fair. You heard some of that today. There's a very delicate balance about getting the emphasis sort of right. It is true that policy at the country level tends to sound more macroeconomic and leaves you with the impression that it's the main event, whereas that's actually the supporting event. And so it almost doesn't, I mean, I can go find the page in which it says the proximate drivers of growth are, you know, entrepreneurs, people who build businesses, entry and exit, competition and whatnot, you know, the things that drive both the statics and the dynamics of a market system. But you still end up, you know, when you turn to the kind of government's role in the area of policy and politics, it sort of sounds like something else. So that's one of the reactions that we get. And but overall, I think people appreciate some combination of the content, the organizing content, and the tone. That's the impression I've got.
What do you think of as the key obstacles to sustained growth and development? I mean, we've talked about today some of the big issues, some of the things around politics, around the environment, yeah. And you mentioned this adding up problem about whether we can take the example of small successful countries and then apply that to others when they're also now we've got two very very big successful countries.
Yeah. I mean, the report isn't quite as clear as I am, but I think, I mean, Bill Klein's the one who's done the most effective work on the adding up problem, at least in the sense of, you know, does it add up to the total demand in the market? And I think his conclusion is tending toward, yes, it does. And it's certainly my conclusion, in part because of the time sequencing. You know, China One of the reasons China is a big challenge right now is they are simultaneously and a pretty global economy dependent, not completely because it's a big domestic market now, economy that's also in a structural transition. So even if we weren't having a global slowdown of significant magnitude, a lot of the noise you hear out of China would be going on anyway because, frankly, in the coastal areas, the incomes are at levels that are sort of like the 1980s in Korea, and some of those businesses aren't going to be around. I mean, I was on the board of Nike. Nike's shoe manufacturing was almost entirely in the 1980s in Taiwan and Korea. I mean, it's just the way it works, right? And so China's going through that set of transitions, so they have very flexible labor markets and whatnot, but it's still, it's hard. And because of the size of the economy, I think Takehito is right. The best way to think about China is it's six different developing economies at different stages of development. And so that makes it even harder. So I guess what I would say is I think China will exit fast enough to let India in, and nobody else is big enough in market share to make a difference. So if we could withstand China, and I think it'll probably work. Second part of that is, well, China did affect the relative prices. It was big enough. And so what's the conclusion from that? The layman's conclusion is you can't compete, or you have to wait. I think the more kind of probably economically correct way to say it is the social return to the investments that go along with growth strategies maybe aren't as high as they were before. And especially if, you know, India and other countries, you know, pick up the slack where China is. Having said that, Bill says, and I agree, that there's a bunch of other adding up problems in the long term. Meaning on a multi-decade horizon, I would say energy pricing and environmental issues are the unknown and maybe unanswerable except by taking the journey with the best incentives you can create and policies globally, whether that'll actually just slow things down. And I can tell you what I think. I'm cautiously optimistic they won't. But that's because I'm a great believer that in the right incentive structures. Let me tell you what I mean by that. We've got all this discussion about climate change. The best possible thing we could do for climate change, because a big chunk of it's energy consumption, is stick the price of energy up. You know, there'll be marvelous responses to that in terms of alternatives and whatnot. And we probably, I mean, I'd be in favor of putting a floor under energy prices. I mean, having a general agreement that we're going to kind of get them up, and then if supply kind of outstrips demand in a downturn of this type, we'll adjust the taxes and make the demand side face a price that has a floor on it. And that'll take a lot of risk out of the alternatives, and you could justify that interference in the market system by the fact there are externalities associated with the consumption of energy and the production of particulates and carbon dioxide and so on. And I think we got a very good chance of kind of innovating our way out of this. The really hard problem, which I'm going to spend a little time on, is how do you get from now until 2050 or 60 with reasonable growth in the developing countries, particularly in the short run when a lot of them are still quite poor. And some of them will be poor, but they're, you know, it's the big ones that matter because the little ones won't make that much of a difference until they get richer. And that's a hard problem. I mean, basically, what you've got to do is design a set of incentives and a way of paying for this stuff that allows them to keep growing but starts you moving toward the targets. It's an interesting dynamic problem. Bottom line is I'm sort of optimistic about that, on those adding up questions. And I think where I'm less optimistic is on the governance side. You know, the countries that aren't growing are the proximate cause of it is dysfunctional governance, which leads to leadership that's doing something else, rearranging from stealing stuff to
not knowing what they're doing to representing the interests of some subgroup, a tribe, a region, you know, whatever. And that, I think, is, it's very hard to know anything systematic about how that turns around. Sometimes a crisis, but it looks, when you stand back from it, an awful lot like luck. But there are demonstration effects. And successful performance with the kind of communications we have among people and a kind of learning, generalized learning curve, people get less and less tolerant of poor performance when there's a clearly better alternative. As time goes on, that those forces get more and more powerful. So I think that, you know, if we have 60 to 70% of the world's population living in countries, you know, where there's clearly a future, even if they're not there yet, it'll have a big impact on the other 30%. I mean, China had a big impact in India. India could sit there and say, well, it's kind of the way the world works. And then this huge country to the north, admittedly not a democracy, sort of said, well, no, actually, maybe it isn't. You know, yeah. And Deng Xiaoping went off to Singapore and then showed up in New York, and he'd never been out of the country. He went, well, this is different. So you never know about those things. They sound kind of anecdotal, but I mean, there's more effective leadership in Africa now. You know, they take responsibility. There's a very slow process that we don't, it's a bad word now because, you know, it's used in the context of interventions like Iraq, about nation building. But there really is a sense in which it's easier to do these hard things, like grow and invest and save a lot and, you know, and do things for your kids and grandkids, if the people in the country sort of more or less think of themselves as kind of united, at least by virtue of their citizenship, being in it together. And it takes a long time for that to happen. I mean, a lot of European countries are 150 years old. Canada's 150 years old. The United States is older than that. The post-colonial countries are, I mean, India's a miracle, but the African countries, you know, are only kind of 50 years into this. And so, and you take China. Most Chinese, except for the outlying territories where they have problems, think of themselves as Han Chinese. Well, why is that? Well, it's because the country was unified, you know, about 100 years before, you know, zero. Maybe 100 B.C., so they've had 2,000 years of people developing a sense that they belong to a country, and it matters, affects their behavior. I don't know that we know how to say anything precise about that, but those things are things that I don't think you can short circuit. And now leaders have an effect on it. They can accelerate the process of people coming to think by virtue of their experience and the way they kind of imagine the world and their own country, that they belong together. I think Lee Kuan Yew did that in Singapore. I mean, it's a little tiny place, but it's very diverse. And he realized it would blow if you don't do that. So I think that's an area in which there's natural breaks and lags, but also things you can do something about.
Mike, you mentioned the global economic downturn, and you mentioned the word crisis. Why don't we close by talking a little bit about that? You published the report in May of last year, and things got really ugly in September of last year. How do you see the relationship between the financial crisis and the potential for recession, perhaps worse, and the growth challenge?
Well, first of all, the part four of the report is sort of, you know, kind of global things that matter to developing country growth. And I think we would have made it longer if we'd known what we know by November 1st. And we would have paid a lot more attention to something that's already covered there but needs more depth and analysis, and that is, what do we need out of the global economy to support kind of everybody, but particularly the aspirations of the developing countries? And second, what kinds of risk-mitigating components of strategy do they wisely adopt on the assumption that we have a fairly volatile global economy and we're not going to just fix that overnight? At least seems very unlikely. And, you know, and the now global financial and economic crisis, which emanated from the advanced countries, would be the kind of poster boy for this. But there are other examples of it. So I think what's going to happen is a number of the commissioners want to have a kind of get-together, a workshop, some distinguished academics, and then try to produce an addendum, which you can think of as extending Part 4, that kind of focuses on this question in a number of categories. Risk mitigation, what can we expect in terms of volatility, what changes in the way the global economy and the global financial system are needed to kind of increase the at least reduce the probability of extreme instability. I think that on this particular episode, the developing countries were like somewhere between, you know, set back a bit and okay up until September, the fall of this year. The reason is the anticipated global slowdown wasn't huge yet. It's true that was going to affect them. There's no way to mitigate that risk, except maybe for the countries that can afford it, that have a big enough domestic market, some fiscal stimulus. And the second one was the commodity price shock, which was actually a major event. It caused inflation and difficult choices between growth and inflation and the food emergency for the poor. I have characterized those as manageable headwinds, but then the advanced countries went into this sort of, double spiral, you know, on the asset and deleveraging side, on the real economy side, which we haven't gotten out of yet. And then right in the middle of the fall, the credit problem spread. And the reason it spread is because the balance sheets in the United States, the financial institutions, were so damaged.
Yeah.
So they started pulling capital. So you can see it. All exchange rates went except China, because China has a lot on its exchange rate. And so everybody went like that. And so they had the double effect of a rise in the liabilities of dollar-denominated liabilities and an extreme drying up of credit just overnight like that. So the combination of a much more extreme global slowdown and the fact that they now have to deal with our exporting of the credit problem, at least for the countries that were reliant on pretty regular access to the global capital markets as part of the sort of the way the financial system functioned, means it actually looks quite a lot uglier now. Every month the IMF revises its forecast and they keep going down. So, and I don't think we're finished yet. So it looks a little tough. On the other hand, assuming we don't have permanent instability at a much heightened level in the global financial system and in the economy, we can tolerate some volatility, and I don't think the fundamental growth strategies are different. But the growth strategies probably have a larger component of risk mitigation in them, including some that are, in an ideal world, these are second best. Okay, the first best is a well-functioning IMF with a huge collection of resources, way more than $250 billion, that can stabilize currencies when they go unstable, especially if they go unstable for this reason, and nothing to do with them, right? Money's just coming out, but we're not going to get that overnight. And so there are a bunch of things, you know, finance most of your investment out of domestic savings. Don't run a big trade deficit. Run up the reserve so you can replace some of the outflows with inflows a little bit. These are nobody would argue in a first best world these are ideal policies. Don't run big fiscal deficits, because the time may come when you need to stimulate the domestic economy through a pattern of public sector expenditure and tax reductions. So you want to be in a position to be able to do that. I think all of these things are going to make developing countries, as they develop their strategies, more conservative. And I think it's right. I mean, so I think we'll probably write a little bit about that as kind of the swan song of the Growth Commission. Yeah.
Let's leave it there. Michael Spence, thank you so much.